Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the Guardian's technology podcast, coming to you every Tuesday from Guardian Towers. I'm Alex Krotowski, and this week we're talking about an information revolution.
We have a recipes wiki and Wikia Green, which is about environmentalism. I mean, there's all kinds of different projects that people are working on.
That was, unsurprisingly, Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales singing the praises of his current projects. But we won't just be hearing about Jimbo's latest flutter. We'll also be looking at what happens when the web's free culture ethos clashes with international politics. With the Google and China row causing heads of state to throw around epithets and position diplomatic rhetoric around so-called cyber warfare, we welcome Kenneth Gears, Cyber Center of Excellence in Tallinn, Estonia's U.S. representative, to discuss how real the virtual threats really are. Joining me in this theater of war are Charles Arthur and Kevin Anderson. Have you guys built your virtual bunkers yet?
I have to say, after the whole China Google thing, I did tighten up the doors and locks on my home computer.
Did that involve simply upgrading away from IE6?
No, I upgraded the locks on my Linux box at home. So,
Charles, I know that you've been cutting down trees and your thumb at the same time.
Yeah.
Have you the thumb
doesn't burn as well as the tree.
But have you done anything like Kevin? Have you been battening down the hatches?
No, not really. I mean, about the most I did was to sort of get rid of a hacker who seemed to be using some code from a Chinese website, or maybe it was Chinese themselves, on the FreeRData website. That was a couple of months ago. That aside, no, I haven't done a great deal in the sort of virtual bunker side of things.
We may find out why we should later on in the program. Also on today's program, we'll be dissecting the latest headlines, including the increasing opposition to the UK government's digital economy bill and the latest on the breakdown of the holes in the tax system. And we'll be hearing what you've been talking about across the network on our blogs. It's gripping stuff, so stick around for the next 30 or so minutes.
Tech Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
The love lost between Google and the Chinese state several weeks ago, starting with the web search giant's emails being hacked and culminating with China's accusations of cyber terrorism against the U.S. government, has focused attention on an escalating and dangerous landscape of emergent warfare. The potential threats are as varied as censorship, currently the alleged modus operandi of choice for the Iranian government in advance of the pre-election protests, to takedowns of crucial systems of governance like communications and commerce, as happened in Estonia in 2007. The Guardian reported last week that cyber threats are increasing in number and nations are woefully unprepared to deal with them. We welcome Kenneth Gears, the U.S. representative to the Cyber Center of Excellence in Tallinn, to take us through the evolution of cyber war. Welcome, Kenneth.
Hello, hello. Hello from Tallinn.
Thank you very much for joining us. I was wondering, first of all, if you could help me define cyber war. What is this new theater that politics and politicians are engaging in?
Right. Well, I think that just as every other aspect of human life is migrating to cyberspace, so is conflict and warfare. And so politicians and, well, boyfriends and girlfriends, as well as military forces, are sort of exchanging blows on the internet. And it's a funny place to do combat because, well, everybody is a neighbor on the internet. And so if you don't like somebody, even if they're on the other side of the world, you can say something mean about them, or you can even try and hack them. It's all in the imagination and the timing and the creativity. Essentially what takes place is I exploit some vulnerability in your system with an attack called an exploit. And so I'm taking advantage of your poor password or your old operating system or your lack of a patch. But what I do when I gain control of the system is entirely up to the imagination. I mean, I can impersonate you. I can steal your data. I can change your data. Now, in a military sense, this is really serious stuff. I mean, if I'm reading my girlfriend's emails, then it's not necessarily a national security threat. Although to her, it's a personal crisis. But on the international scene, if I can get access to a computer of yours that you are using to control critical infrastructure or to run your air defense system, then that is a national security crisis and something that your president or prime minister would probably want to know about.
Is that form of cyber threat increasing? Are we actually experiencing more and more of these cyber attacks that aren't necessarily of the personal nature, as you alluded to, you know, a boyfriend or girlfriend reading somebody's online diaries or emails? Are these types of things, these attacks against entire systems, growing?
I think so. There's really not much reason to broadcast that you have been hacked if you're a bank or an insurance company. Or a government. I mean, sometimes you can, and that's really what makes the Google case so fascinating and unique. And in part, it's the very public nature of it. Not only publicly pointing a finger at a country, but also bringing in an intelligence agency. This is amazing stuff, and it is actually bringing a lot of pressure to bear on, say, China in this case, because Google is saying, look, we're going to stop cooperating with you if you don't play more nicely with us. And not only that, but we are going to seek the expert and experienced advice of our own Signals Intelligence Agency to batten down the hatches within our corporation.
Kenneth, it's Charles Arthur. Why do you think it was that Google went so high profile in this way? And why do you think that they assigned it to the Chinese government? Because I just want to compare it with two other things. There was the attack on Estonia that Alex referred to earlier, for which the sort of general thinking now seems to be it wasn't actually an attack by the Russian government or even a sort of Russian state-sponsored organization, that it was more a sort of crew of hackers in Russia who sort of had the same line of thinking as the Russian government but weren't really sponsored by them. Mm-hmm. Then you have, for example, the climate Gate email hack, which isn't a trivial hack, but again, people don't seem to be assigning that to a particular country. Whereas with this Google one and the 30 associated companies, people are suggesting that it's China behind it. Where do you think the line gets drawn, and why do people impute motives to a government in one instance and not in others?
Well, I don't have inside information on Google's thinking. My own guess was that they were at Google extremely frustrated. They're operating obviously out of China and working with China on issues, and for them to have come out so publicly in an accusatory fashion, I think that must have signaled a really high level of frustration. Second, I think bringing in the NSA into the picture must also have been some kind of a retaliatory measure or some level of deterrence that they wanted to achieve vis-a-vis who they perceived was an adversary. It's hard to explain it otherwise because, well, you can see how people who are using Google for searches or for email would be offended or would fear their relationship with the NSA. And so to do so strikes me as maybe somewhat risky for the company.
Well, many thanks, Kenneth. We look forward to covering the unfolding diplomatic virtual risk game over the coming years from the safety of our screens.
Tech Weekly from The Guardian.
Here's the other headlines that have caught our eyes this week.
Brushing aside growing opposition to the digital economy bill, the government moved a step closer to passing its vision for a digital Britain. Members of the House of Lords had criticized the bill for its failure of due process for people accused of illicit file sharing under its three strikes provisions. Hotels and educators had also complained that the bill threatened their businesses and their ability to offer the internet to the public by holding organizations providing net access liable for the actions of their customers. Conservative Lord Ralph Lucas was rebuffed in his attempts to amend legislation to allow format shifting, to enshrine the right to link on the web, and to grant search engines immunity for republishing excerpts of other websites. Committee debate is now finished in the House of Lords. It will go to the report stage in 14 days, before a third reading and passage to the House of Commons for additional debate. Death in taxes may be certain, but it's not certain if HM Revenue and Custom has got your taxes right this year. The British tax collectors have admitted that an error was introduced when they created a new database for the collection of income tax. The error meant that some taxpayers received the wrong code, and a tax group has also found at least 7 different errors with coding for pensioners. The Revenue Office said the vast majority of codes would be correct, but said that people concerned about their codes should check it using the guidance included with the code and on their website.
The Digital Economy Bill, Charles, you wrote something last week on the site about an increasing amount of opposition. Who's opposing? What are they opposing?
Well, they're opposing the provisions of the Digital Economy Bill. There's various bits of it. I mean, it principally comes down to the proposal that people who provide an internet service to others where there is illicit file sharing going on or whatever, or copyright infringement going on through that service, would have to in some way provide information. The British Hospitality Association, which represents hotels and shops and so on, wrote to Lord Mandelson saying this is really a bad idea because it puts a lot of cost onto hotels and so on to keep details about people, which they might not be able to keep if people have got sort of prepaid card or something. So, for example, a hotel might find that its internet connection has been used, that it's required to sort of provide details about the person, but it doesn't have any details to give. And also universities wrote to Lord Mandelson as well, said, well, they wrote to Lord Putnam, but I think they were asking him to send it on, making much the same point, making the point that for example, the British Library provides a Wi-Fi access system. If someone comes in there, do they have to tag everyone? And that basically the costs of implementing this are very much pushed onto the providers in this way and not onto the people who are complaining about infringement of copyright. And they feel that this is rather asymmetrical and unfair because they, the providers, don't get any benefit if people don't do infringement, but the people who are complaining of infringement do get the benefits. So, in effect, they're sort of getting a free rider.
What is the timeline on this bill? How far away are we from it becoming something that sticks to law?
It's rather hard to know. It's progressing at the moment. It's going through the Lords and it's had various amendments put down and taken up and put down on it. It has to, if I'm understanding it correctly, it has to go through the Lords, the Commons, the Lords, the Commons, and I think there's then a committee stage as well, Royal Assent. So it's still got a fair while to go, and I don't think that I simply don't see how they can get it through, given that the MPs are just about to have their half-term break, before they have to break and have a general election. You know, I said as a prediction for the year that I think that the bill's going to fall, and I think that all this sort of opposition is just part of it, because if they have to rewrite the bill in some way, that complicates it even more.
Well, it's not a very good news week for government and digital, is it? Because there's also the issues of the tax codes. What's been going on there? I was quite petrified to hear that I may have paid too much tax. Is that right?
No, it's that the tax codes for the upcoming year, the HM Revenue and Customs has moved all of its tax coding systems onto new computers, a new computer system which they were going to introduce in 2008, but they said, no, we're going to take a little longer and get it right. And so they've taken a little longer and still haven't got it right. So if you've had a tax code letter, or when you do get a tax code letter saying your tax code for next year is going to be such and such, go and check it. Make sure that it is correct, because it seems that they're sending out a lot of them which are wrong. And people within HM Revenue and Customs have been telling various of the money programs about this. It's a systems migration problem.
So if people need to find out, then they just go to the HMRC website, probably.
You should be able to go to the HMRC website and find out, but you may find that's difficult, in which case you may have to try and see if you have the patience of Job and hang on a telephone line for it.
Yes, I've heard stories, but I'm not going to go into those stories right now about those telephone lines. One thing, just don't send a paper letter. That's my only piece of advice. And finally, and this is an additional piece of news, but there is a new law in South Australia that's banned anyone from leaving anonymous comments on blogs. It was originally intended to apply only to the election coverage, the local election coverage, but the law is loose enough that it can actually apply across all user-generated contribution content. So we're not going to be focusing on that this week, and we're not going to be talking about Australia this week, but next week We are going to be talking about Australia because there's more insidious cyber censorship that we're going to be tackling on the podcast. So until then, you can read up on all these stories and the rest of the headlines at guardian.co.uk/technology. Jimmy Wales, creator of the user-generated encyclopedia Wikipedia, has positioned himself as a spokesperson for free culture, a movement promoted by a tranche of the Weberati who believe that an open system of information consumed and created by audiences is the vision of a brighter tomorrow. He recently spoke at the Digital Life Design Conference in Munich about disruptive technologies, where he promoted his new adventure, SearchWikia, a human-powered social searching application based on the guiding principles of the community-driven Wikipedia. Mercedes Bunz caught up with him after his talk and began asking what Wikia actually was.
Wikipedia is owned by the Wikimedia Foundation, which is a charity, and Wikia is a for-profit company. In terms of what's different about the websites, at Wikipedia is the encyclopedia, and at Wikia we say we're building the rest of the library. So it's every other kind of book or work that people might want to collaborate on. Everything from humor sites like Uncyclopedia, which is quite funny, and dominated by British people, actually. And we have a recipes wiki and... Wikia Green, which is about environmentalism. I mean, there's all kinds of different projects that people are working on.
Everybody is concerned if Wikipedia will have advertisements soon. On the DLD conference recently, you commented about that.
Yeah, somebody asked me about it, and I quoted Craig Newmark of Craigslist, who always says whenever people ask why he doesn't charge for things or whatever, he says the customers haven't asked us to yet. So I took that line up to say, well, look, we don't really need the money. There are valid arguments for and against advertising. We have no interest in pursuing it, but I think most people really love Wikipedia the way it is, and we'd like to keep it the way it is.
Everybody says that 2010 is going to be the big year of the mobile. Wikipedia already has a mobile application. What do you think about the future?
Well, for me, when I think about the future and mobile, I don't know what's going to happen in the developed world. Faster, better, cooler phones and all kinds of innovation. I'm really excited about it. But for me, was really the humanitarian impact is that all those people in the developing world who are now have mobile devices, who are getting mobile devices, they are currently using very basic phones typically. But in the next 5 to 10 years, they're going to start to have smartphones with access to the internet. They'll have the equivalent of an iPhone, that level of phone in some of the poorest places in the world, which will give people access to information, access to knowledge in a way that they've never had before.
We heard the news, there was a study recently that a lot of Wikipedia editors are leaving Wikipedia. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, the study was completely wrong, and they've actually retracted it, or parts of it. The study was based on a very simple methodological error. We reran all the numbers and showed it to them, and they're like, oh, So the truth is that the number of people editing Wikipedia has been stable for about 2 years. The story that we've lost 49,000 editors is just not true.
Recently, you became board of directors of Hunch. Can you explain a little bit what Hunch is?
Yeah, so Hunch is Hunch.com. This is a new company. A friend of mine, Katarina Fake, who was one of the co-founders of Flickr, is also with Hunch. She actually works there every day. She's a fabulous product designer. And what they're doing, it's a decision engine. So you go to Hunch, and maybe you have a question like, I'm thinking of buying a digital camera, but I don't know which one I should buy. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting combination of both user-generated content and algorithms. So users come in and write questions and answers, and then it's a whole decision tree, but it gets rebalanced by the algorithm based on people's votes on the results in the end. I don't understand the technology behind it. All I know is it's kind of cool, right? And so you can go there, and it'll say things like, if you say what digital camera should I buy, it may say, well, are you interested in getting really into photography, or you just want to take some snapshots? You know, how much, how big, how small, how much do you want to spend? All these kinds of questions like this, you know, is it more important to you to have, are you going to take pictures in low light, or are you going to be taking pictures of sports or something like that? I don't even know what all the questions would be. And at the end, it makes a recommendation to you based on all of the characteristics that you specified. I think it's really cool, and it's growing very quickly. People find it fun to play with. It's, you know, go and goof around with it, and it's kind of cool. So I'm excited about it, and I mean, I have great respect for Katarina as a product designer, and then I've met the team. There's a bunch of super smart MIT guys there, much smarter than me. So I think that combination, right, of super smart algorithm people plus Katarina as product designer, I think it's going to be cool.
That was Mercedes Bunce speaking with Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales. So, Kevin, it's been almost 10 years since Wikipedia was launched. It was launched in 2001, this big sort of free culture, everybody can contribute. Is it working, or if, in fact, it isn't working, is, you know, we've got all these editors who are supposedly, allegedly fleeing, but in fact aren't. Is it working, or is it just going to disappear?
Well, the thing is, I think as all communities go through phases online, I think Wikipedia is going through an important phase right now. And I think that it's not that the editors are fleeing as much as they're having difficulty bringing in new blood. And part of that is that the editors are exercising a great deal of... So it's incredibly difficult if you're a first-time contributor to Wikipedia to actually get something submitted to Wikipedia, because you've got people who are sitting on those entries and deleting stuff. So you've got the, you know, what is it, the inclusionists and the deletionists, the two camps in Wikipedia. So I think it's going to be a real challenge to – and on one side, they've got people saying, well, we have to increase the quality. And on another side, you've got people saying we have to increase the contributions, because it's sort of, you know, ossified into this narrow bit – or, well, it's quite broad bit, actually, of contributors. So it's an evolution. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, it's good enough. But will it be good enough in the future, I think, is something that even Wikipedians are struggling with right now.
Well, I think Jimmy Wales, given, you know, the variety of pies that he has his fingers in, is searching for something that will maintain, you know, him as a speaker for free culture and free movement. And I have questions about Wikia. It looks to me as if it's honestly, Charles, what is Wikia? Is it useful? I don't really understand how it's any different from what we already have that's out there.
I think a lot of people have the sort of look to Jimmy Wales for his next great idea, and are sort of continually not quite overwhelmed. You know, they sort of go, okay, Jimmy, okay, pull the curtain back. And then, we were sort of hoping that it'd be like Wikipedia, which is really... And people forget a bit how Wikipedia was very slow at the start and then just exploded in terms of content and effectiveness and usefulness. So possibly it's sort of looking at Wikipedia soon, but I don't know. I get the feeling that you know, everyone has one really great project inside them, and that may have been it. But, you know, time will tell, I guess.
Well, I think, you know, and when you look at the recent research just out from the Pew Internet and American Life research last week, that younger people are starting to abandon blogging. And I think, you know, what we're finding is that, you know, creating content, whether it's Wikipedia or blogging or long-form writing, it's, you know, Stowe Boyd, who's a social media consultant or guru, whatever, says, you know, blogging is like slogging. That's what it should be called, because it's just an awful lot of work. So, you know, the burnout rate on people doing stuff like that is really big, and you have to get something out of it. And some of it's psychological and, you know, rewards, but there's a lot of people, especially in 2010, that, you know, show me the money or, you know, I got to feed my kids. So I think that's what... It's not just an evolution of Wikipedia. It's also maybe the global economy moving on.
I think there's also just the fact that, you know, for anyone who wants to do something, you need a bit of reward. And the thing about Wikipedia, certainly in the early days, was you wrote the page or you contributed to the article, and there it was. It stayed there. Whereas I think what's happened is that a lot of the articles have reached the stage now where you add something and an editor will come along and will knock it back. And it doesn't take too many occasions of being knocked back and someone will say, oh, well, I'll go somewhere else and do something else. And it's much like that with blogging. You know, everyone finds that it's easier to consume content than to create content, which is why you have a group of people who do create content, you know, people who make films and people who sort of write stuff, you know, authors and things, and they're really working hard at it. And the fact that they're slogging away at it is because they're really dedicated to it. And it's quite easy to lose the fact that it's very hard to do.
It's also very easy for designers to have visions that, ah, yes, and the community will instantly appear. And this is something that I call the if you build it, they will come problem. And I potentially see that with something like Hunch.com, which Wales said he's now on the executive board, because it is ultimately, it's a social search that demands that people actually rate things. It demands that people direct other people, an expert system that demands that other people rate things and direct you in that particular way. But if you don't have those experts, if you don't have those people who own it, then why should people engage with this system?
I think it goes back actually to you know, people say what is Web 2.0, and I think actually O'Reilly and co gave a really good definition, which is Web 2.0 sites were the sites that succeeded after the ashes of the .com crash, and they succeeded why? Because the value to their own users increased the more people that use them. And so I think, you know, for Hunch or any site that has a social component to succeed, the users have to derive some value out of it. And that might be their reward. So if Hunch delivers better answers to whatever questions people have, then they'll contribute to it. But I think so many of these are it's not just a build it and they will come. It's build this cool thing for us for free, and we'll take all the value out of it, and, you know, thank you very much. Goodbye.
Yeah, Hunch is intriguing. I mean, I look at it, and it feels to me like a 1980s expert system sort of pushing you through the questions. And it's not quite the same as, say, asking a question on Twitter. If once you get to a certain number of followers on Twitter and you ask a question there, then you tend to get a response which will actually be sort of useful to you in a much more direct fashion. So I don't know. Hunch seems to me to be just teetering on the edge of usefulness, and it could fall and vanish, or it could suddenly tip over into being really amazing.
Well, we'll keep our eye on Hunch, definitely. But also, for more on Wales and his project, and for more information on the free culture movement in general from Lawrence Lessig, its godfather, then head to our website, guardian.co.uk/technology. What has been happening on the blogs? Charles, what's been going on in technology?
Oh, well, it's been very busy, actually. We've had sort of 100-plus comments on various of the things. But last Friday, we had the tale of the Vodafone tweet, where the person who was Vodafone's PR on Twitter left their desk unattended. This is up in Stoke. Is there something about Stoke, folks? Another colleague came along and sent out a pretty rude tweet, with the result that when the person who was the Vodafone PR came back to the desk, he was, "My God, what have you done?" And then had to spend pretty much 3 or 4 hours pasting exactly the same text in, saying, "No, it was an accident. It was real, but we haven't been hacked, but we're really sorry, and please don't go in."
No.
Sort of the total Homer Simpson moment. In the comments on the story, we had Nice Man Dan, who commented, "The downside to intimate customer communication. A few years ago, I worked for a large company that used another company to send regular marketing emails to customers, i.e. spam. Unfortunately, someone accidentally sent a test email full of colourful language to 75,000 customers. Luckily, there were only a few complaints, and the press never caught wind of it. Perversely, it's a good barometer of who is actually reading your spam. The company who sent the email was fired, and no more emails were sent to customers because, after that episode, we realised nobody was reading them anyway."
Well, you did something the other day, didn't you, on the blog, asking for people's most humiliating social media.
The worst tweets. Yeah.
So you could see the results of that on the website. Is that right?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, we did the five biggest Twitter gaffes sort of thing, which most of which seem to involve sports men. Actually, they all were. There was Darren Bent. There was one of the cricketers. There's Mark Cuban, who got fined a whole load of money, and large amounts of money that they're being fined for sort of saying things on Twitter, basically.
Red faces all around. Well, a slightly more highbrow experience was happening over on the games blog, because Dante's Inferno has been translated into an interactive entertainment device, if you believe it. And Greg posted about this. Both Greg and Keith posted about this. And Kesmo commented on the concept of making a game about the lyric poem. He said, "The important point is here is that regardless of its integrity to the source material, this is a game inspired by literature. Makes for a refreshing change from yet another cynical paint-by-numbers movie tie-in." And indeed, Keith then created a Friday question asking what other literature should be encouraged to create, to be turned into a computer game. After Dante's Inferno, which classic work of literature should be turned into a game next, he asks. And Adam Bolt says, "I'd quite like to see Wuthering Heights as a side-scrolling beat-em-up." And English Red said, "Pride and Prejudice. It could have a dancing element." And Jeez. I love the idea. Kevin, so what was going on in the not-so-highbrow world of computer games, non-computer games?
Well, we over on PDA, the digital content blog, of course, I referred to the study looking at how people are using online, and it found only 19% of adult internet users use Twitter or similar services. And Boombox goes, "So 81% of adult internet users are not neurotic, insecure, middle-aged narcissists. Something to celebrate." I don't know if you've all noticed this, but Twitter seems to be the great divide in terms...
It's the Marmite.
It is the Marmite.
It is. It's totally Marmite. And it's funny because... if I even reference a good quote on Twitter, I have those who don't care and those who think that I have just ripped out the soul of journalism and stomped on it with 6-inch heels.
Which you have, of course. I've
of
seen
course,
those heels.
Of course, yes.
Very
and,
nice.
I personally am self-loathing. I hate journalism. That's die.
Meanwhile, we at Tech Weekly have been getting a lot of feedback on last week's program, in particular the discussion about the war between Macmillan and Amazon. I like this one from Rompompom, which is quite a serious comment. Rompompom says, "Amazon caved because they would have been gimping their range." I like that choice of words. Other publisher houses should follow Macmillan's lead for themselves and for their authors. So you can enter into a discussion about that. Our Twitter name is @GuardianTW. And finally, we asked for your thoughts on new features that you'd like to see on Tech Weekly, and we received loads of suggestions, including some more interesting introductions from DSR Jarman. You'd like more interesting introductions. I'll see what I can do. But the most consistent requests were for more Jack, more Jack Schofield. Alan Evans and Wowzer808 were particularly vocal about that. And lots of people were asking when Jemima's coming back, and she'll be back at the end of March. Anyway, you can head to our variety of social media, Twitter, Flickr, Facebook, to give us your opinion on, well, anything. But do keep it topical and preferably clean, would you? All the links are on our website, guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Thanks to our guests, Jimmy Wales and Kenneth Gears. Thanks as well to our podtastic studio team, Charles Arthur and Kevin Anderson, and to today's mighty fine producer, Fran. Next week, we're looking at internet censorship, but not in China or even Iran. No, we'll be dissecting the Great Firewall Down Under in Australia. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next Tuesday.